therefore, by definition, the chassis was 60 volts above ground, AC-wise, because there was no grounding on the whole system. So what we used to do years ago by modern standards is pretty risky. I wonder what electrolytic capacitor experience you've had, John. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Oh yes, Dick, a lot. One important thing, which I'm sure you know, you have to realize that about 45 years ago is just about when they turned to venting the electrolytics. So Rich is doing the right thing, and people who are restoring old radios should be aware of that. The ones that are not vented can actually explode. And reforming electrolytics, if they're on the shelf for more than a year or two, you should reform them. But they can explode like a bomb if they're not of the vented type, so it's best to change them anyway.
Okay, that's a good piece of information you brought us, Rich. Rich has been restoring quite a few pieces of vintage equipment, and so although quite a few of us will go to a flea market and find something that's quite a few years old, and we think we're just going to plug it in and play it, particularly a high-power amplifier, which have got the great big high-voltage capacitors in there, and some of the modern-day single-sideband afterburner-type amplifiers have these electrolytic capacitors used in series-parallel combinations. And if they haven't been used for some time, we gotta treat them with tender loving care. Let's go over to Bennett now. KO2OK. A question. Vic, WA2ARQ, Whiskey Alpha 2, Alpha Romeo, Quebec. You started talking to us about a 6L6 power supply with 170 volts AC, 120 volts AC, and it blew a fuse. Give us a few more words on that one, Vic. W2ARQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, K2RIW, WA2ARQ. N2EO, Rich, and KC2WGB, John. Very good, guys. Yeah, we're on 75 meters. case in point, I have a Hamelin HQ170A that I bought about 2 years ago that was brought up by the Variac, and so far so good. So I only had to replace one IF tube in it, and it's working well. And the Viking Ranger 2 I have for plate modulated on 75 meters. This modulator is for the Adventure that I have, and also a DX40. So yeah, it's a 115 volt primary on the coil, on the transformer, 170 volt, one of the three taps is 170 volt AC secondary. And I just started wiring it, and I got the mod iron and everything going on, and I just wired it to a switch and put a fuse on the black side. It's only a two wire a power cord. Of three, but put a fuse on the black side of the cord and turn it on. Now, should I have blown a 2-amp fuse, or am I I'm at a loss here, because let me break for the repeater. Because I have built equipment in the past, I'm licensed since 1958. But always with kits that, you know, tell you exactly what to do. This is this schematic is from a friend of mine, and it is it's a pretty straightforward voltage doubler with a couple of IN 1007s in it, or 1009s in it, to double it up to 450. But those aren't even in play yet. Am I doing something wrong, Rich? Dick, go ahead.
Okay, you're not loading the power supply, you're just turning it on, in which case a 2 ampere fuse should not blow, and it does sound like there is an error. I think I would go step by step and first disconnect the secondary of the transformer, the 170 volt lead, and just simply apply primary voltage to it to make sure that the transformer doesn't have a shorted turn or an internal short. So by disconnecting various things and studying the schematic diagram, I think you'll eventually find out where the high current is coming from. What Rich does, which is a very safe thing to do, when he's powering up some brand new piece of electronics that runs on the 120 volt AC line, in order to protect him from short circuits, in order to not burn up a whole box full of fuses, so to speak, he doesn't use fuses. He just simply runs the circuit through a 100 volt light bulb or a 50 watt light bulb, depending on how many watts the circuit is. In other words, if your 110 volt line, one wire goes straight to the transformer, one wire goes to one lead of a 120 volt light bulb, and the other lead goes back to the circuit. Now, if something is wrong with the circuit and it draws and it acts like a dead short, it'll simply light up the light bulb full speed, full brilliance, and you won't be blowing any fuses. The light bulb is an automatic protection circuit. The magic of a light bulb, let me drop, is that the cold resistance versus the hot resistance of a light bulb is more than a 10-to-1 ratio, in many cases 15-to-1. In other words, when the light bulb is at full brilliance at, let's say, 100 watts, and 1 ampere is flowing through it, the light bulb is acting like a 120-ohm resistor. But when the light bulb is cold, it is acting like 1/15th of that. It's only a couple of ohms. So if your circuit is operating correctly, the light bulb will only give you a couple of volts of drop, and it's a safe way to go. If your circuit's a short circuit, the light bulb goes to full brilliance and goes to 15 times higher resistance and doesn't blow any fuses. So by putting that kind of a safety circuit in your power supply as you start connecting and disconnecting things one step at a time to find out, do you have a shorted diode? Do you have a shorted capacitor? Is the voltage multiplier network wired backwards or forwards and so on? Ohm meters across the diodes. Measuring diodes, by the way, you have to use the so-called diode scale of an ohm meter, not just the ordinary ohm meter scale, because high voltage diodes sometimes, because the ohm meter only puts 1.5 or 3 volts on them, it doesn't get a chance to completely turn on the diode. If it's a high voltage diode, it's got really 3 diodes in series inside the package, and so you'll measure open circuit in both directions, and you won't know what's going on. So I'd recommend the light bulb circuit before you proceed is one way to go, Vic. WA2ARQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment in 2 EMs. Very good, Dick. And that's on the primary circuit, right? I don't have any of the voltage doubler diodes in there. I mean, I'm just going through on the 170 volt secondary. I'm only going through a fuse to a double pole double throw switch with a the only thing that's in parallel with that is 115 volt pilot light little plastic front panel pilot light. So you think that it possibly could be a short in the transformer? Is that if I'm hearing you correctly? N2EO comment.
If nothing but the transformer is hooked up and you're blowing fuses, without a doubt you've got a short in the transformer or something funny in the wiring that you don't know about. Rich, go ahead with your suggestion. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, I didn't wait for the full beep. I'll be going to be set. Okay. What I was going to suggest to him is that he take an ohm meter with the transformer unplugged from the wall, no power, and check the primary and all the secondaries and see if there's an internal short to the case of the transformer. Sometimes what'll happen is a winding will short to the case on the secondary, especially on the high voltage windings. So even though he's got nothing connected to the leads, he's got a short between the winding and the case, so it's going to draw current. Also check from each winding, like the filament winding to the high voltage winding to the medium voltage, check all combinations and make sure that it's an open circuit between all the windings, and all the windings do not read continuity to the case of the transformer. Also, what some people do, and it's very dangerous, what some people will do when the transformer shorts to the case, they'll say, oh, well, I'll just take the transformer and put it up on 4 standoff insulators so the case is no
works fine. The problem is if somebody else comes along years later or you forget and you put one hand on the chassis and one hand on the transformer, you're dead. Back to net until we help.
Good question, Dick.
Very fine, Rich. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I want you to ask the gentleman, is that a multi-tap primary? And to make sure that the taps aren't confused, that's a big problem also with multi-tap primaries.
Yeah, some transformers will have a common wire and then a wire intended for 105, 110, 115, and 120 volts, so to speak. And if you're across the two wires that are between the 115 and the 110, you're only using a small number of turns of the transformer. Rich's ohmmeter test is a good one. Each one of the wires, each one of the windings of the transformer should be thoroughly isolated from the chassis, thoroughly isolated from each other. And while you're using the ohmmeter on the low ohm scales, if you know how to use the ohmmeter, you'll watch the ohmmeter move in a characteristic manner when you put it across the primary winding or the high voltage secondary winding. You'll see the ohmmeter climb up slowly as you're charging the inductance of the winding. Inductor primary windings and secondary windings of a transformer act in that manner. You're charging the inductor, the ohmmeter is doing that, and it moves in a characteristic manner. If the transformer had a shorted turn, so that the total amount of inductance of the transformer is a small fraction of what it's supposed to be, it will not behave in that manner. You might measure almost the right number of ohms for the primary, but it will not kick in the it will not climb in the slow characteristic manner. So, as I see it, your next step is divide and conquer. Run nothing but the transformer with your ohmmeter, the transformer with a light bulb circuit, and if that's drawing high current, stop right there before you hook up the rest of the circuit. So it looks to me like you're going to disconnect everything and slowly add the stuff back is one method of troubleshooting by a kind of divide and conquer there, Vic. W-A-2-A-R-Q, and come back and let us know what you find. K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet, W-A-2-A-R-Q. Very good, Dick. Excellent. This transformer has been checked out over my buddy's house. It has been put on a variac. There are two windings on the primary that initially we had, you know, had to do a little bit of back and forth until we got them both in correct polarities. So those were hooked up correctly, and as I said, we did put it on a variac and brought it up all the way up to 115 volts, and on the other side we got the 170, and there's three taps on the secondary, which are two taps which are six volt taps, and the other one which is the high voltage 170. So we're going to have to do a little bit of, as you said, divide and conquering here, and we don't really have a heck of a lot of test equipment here, and as I said, this is only my second go-around at just doing some homebrew outside of building something from a kit with step-by-step instructions. Thanks, guys. I don't want to take up any more of your time, and I really appreciate it, and I will get back to you one of these Sunday evenings and let you know what we come up with. Okay, back to K2RIW, WA2ARQ will now be off clear in QRT. Have a great night, guys, and thanks a lot.
Another comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, he talked about, he said polarity. What he meant was putting the windings in phase. They got to be in the two, if there's two windings, sometimes on the transformer you have two windings, 220 volt windings, parallel for 110, series for 220. 220, you just put them in series, but 110, if you're not sure how to get the phase right, you put them in parallel, but on one side, put a VTVM, a voltmeter, like on a 150 volt AC scale, parallel one side directly, instead of putting a wire across the other side, put a meter across there. If you see voltage, you've got them bucking. The phase is wrong. Turn one winding around, check it again. The voltage should be zero. That's how you know they're in phase. Go ahead, Dick.
With those two winding type primaries, that's a safe thing to do. The color code is supposed to tell you how to do that, although nowadays many of us don't know that color code anymore. And so there's ways of electrically checking. The light bulb circuit would give you some protection. Power up only one winding and look at the voltage on the other winding when only one of the wires is hooked up to the first primary, the live winding. And if you got it correct, say for instance, winding number one and two are wire number one and two are winding number one, wire number three and four are winding number two, and if you put the 110 volts through the light bulb circuit to be safe into wire one and two, the first winding, and connect lead number three to lead number one, and then look between lead number four and lead number two. In other words, if you're about to put them in parallel in that combination, then the voltage drop between the unused wire and the wire you're about to connect to better be a very small number of volts, like under 1 volt. And if you measure 240 volts, you know you got it backwards. So your AC voltmeter will help you in that case. Divide and conquer. You got to go slow. Okay. There's a carryover from last week or the week before that I think should definitely be discussed with John and Wesley's situation. That's the word plasma. When you Google the word plasma and electron density, you'll get a very nice article that I'm looking at right now out of Google, which is a Wikipedia, and they tell you an awful lot. But let me give you an example of something that has been misunderstood a lot. When I listen to some of our past conversations, I realize there's one very clear point, one very poignant point about plasmas we did not make clear.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And about the best way I can put it is there are plasmas and there are plasmas. Say, for instance, I'm now studying a simple thing called resistor. And I've got a bunch of resistors sitting on the table in front of me. One of them could be intended for high current monitoring, and it might be a tenth of an ohm or a hundredth of an ohm. Another one might be a 1 ohm resistor, a 10 ohm resistor, a 100 ohm, a 1,000 ohm, a 10,000, a 100,000, a 10 mega ohm. All of these things are called resistor. But as you can tell, the total number of ohms between them could be many orders of magnitude different, and yet every one of them is a resistor. Now let's talk about plasmas. There are plasmas and there are plasmas. When I create a high voltage arc between two terminals that are close together, and I pour an ampere through that arc, I have an extremely intense, bright plasma. And because plasmas of an arc have a negative resistance, they have this peculiar characteristic that if I'm pouring 1 ampere through it with some kind of a constant current power supply, and I decide to put 2 amps through it instead through the arc, and I measure the voltage drop across the arc, when I go from 1 amp to 2 amps, in general, the voltage across the arc, you would think it's going to go up. It goes down. That's what negative resistance means. When you get higher amounts of ionization of that particular arc that is a plasma, this negative resistance characteristic means that more current gives you less voltage drop. A really intense plasma, an arc, comes from a lightning bolt. But let me now discuss the real plasmas that we've been discussing up till now. When it comes to the plasma called ionosphere, it has an extremely low density. The number of mobile electrons in that plasma is extremely small. You and I might put our two probes, we fly in our rocket ship, so to speak. We go up to the 100-kilometer altitude. I'm right in the middle of the ionosphere. I put my two probes out the window, so to speak. I'm wearing a spacesuit. And I measure my ohm meter between those two probes. I'm in a conducting plasma, and I expect to measure the degree of conductivity. And my two great big probes, maybe there's a metallic sphere, 6 inches diameter, on the end of each of my probes. and I got the two probes 2 feet apart, so to speak, and I'm now using a very high precision, high impedance ohmmeter. And I'm in the middle of the ionosphere on a day when the maximum usable frequency is a nice high frequency. It might be up at 35 megacycles, so to speak. And I might measure in that particular condition many gigohms of apparent impedance. So in other words, the amount of electron mobility of that particular plasma, because it's a very low density environment that I'm in, I'm very high up in the atmosphere of this Earth, I'm almost in free space. In fact, technically speaking, 100 kilometers is considered the threshold of space. That's the definition of the threshold of space, 62 miles or 100 kilometers. So I'm right at the threshold of space, with the, I'm almost above the whole atmosphere, and for that reason, because the atmosphere is so tenuous up there, so low in density, let me drop, that the atmosphere is so low in density that the mean free path is a very large number. In other words, a particular air molecule starts moving at its characteristic speed, air at normal room temperature. Every air molecule at normal room temperature is moving more than 500 meters per second of average velocity. That's what the definition of temperature is. An air molecule that's in your room right now, if it's at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly 23 or 20 or 25, something like that, degrees centigrade, every one of those air molecules on average is moving slightly more than 500 meters per second, beyond the speed of sound, something like 1.3 times the speed of sound. How far does that molecule move before it hits another molecule of air is called the mean free path. When you're up at the ionosphere, which is very, very low in pressure, the mean free path is a huge number. As such, the ultraviolet rays coming out of the sun and are creating ionization. The solar wind is causing the particles of solar wind moving at a million miles an hour toward the Earth are impacting those air molecules, and they create impact ionization. So there's at least two procedures by which those molecules are being ionized, but they're very far apart, and their conductivity is extremely low. But when you and I send a radio wave up to that ionosphere, our radio wave, by the time it gets there, is lighting up a number of cubic miles of that medium, and the number of cubic miles of that medium lit up by the 20-meter signal coming out of your dipole antenna is giving you some kind of average volumetric reflection, refraction, deflection, or whatever. The atmosphere is bending your wave, and some portion of it comes back down to Earth, and it continues over toward the DX station you want to talk to. So the word ionization and the word
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The word plasma and the word arc and ionization have huge orders of magnitude of difference depending on what is the pressure of the medium, what's the amount of voltage, what's the amount of current that's flowing through it. Tremendous differences occur. That arc that I draw across my high voltage machine down here at sea level is an extremely intense plasma compared to the ionosphere. I know that Wesley was asking me a question along the lines of, would my electronic circuit that is in an unshielded package brought up to the altitude of that ionosphere, would it think that it's in a short circuit? Would the circuit stop working? And in general, the answer is no. That's a very low-density plasma, even though by ionospheric standards, it could be at relatively high ionospheric density as far as maximum usable frequency is concerned. I'm far from an expert on plasmas. I know there's a lot we don't know about them, but we've been lumping together huge order magnitudes of difference of different kinds of plasmas. And so we have to start off knowing there's a lot of difference before we can proceed with some of our conversations. I know you've had a couple of questions you would like to ask, John, on antennas, plasmas, whatever. The subject is yours. The choice is yours. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Mel, and by the way, Happy New Year, guys. my question tonight is, I need you to give me sort of an anthology on the an antenna that I can't find too much about, and that's the Helix. Its development, its use, its weak points, and how it works. So back to you if you have time to do that.
And after you finish with John, I have a question. Also.
Yeah, very fine, Wesley. You're going to be right after John. The inventor appears to be John Krauss. John Krauss, in his first book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, has a significant chapter on the Helix antenna, and you probably know that his very first significant radio telescope was an array, a phased array of 96 helixes set up at Ohio University, at the Wesleyan Ohio University Radio Telescope. So Helix antennas, and also the Vermilion River Telescope in Illinois, at University of Illinois, also used Helix antennas. A number of people have used Helix antennas as a feed horn for a parabolic dish. There's some pros and cons on that one. A Helix antenna and a Yagi antenna have an awful lot in common. Let me drop. In the case of a Helix antenna, it does some things that are really opposite of common sense. Let's assume that I constructed a properly designed clockwise helix antenna. That is to say, when I look down the axis of the helix, it is wound in such a way that it is similar to a right-handed screw thread on a 632 screw, so to speak. And I call that a right-handed helix. The right-handed helix, by IEEE definition, emits a wave that is clockwise, circular, polarized. So a right-handed helix gives you a right-handed signal. I'll warn you, the signal that actually comes out of that antenna, by the definition of classic physics, is left-handed, circular, polarized. The helix, the individual pieces of wire of that helix, are radiating at right angles to the wire, opposite of common sense. You would think the signal is traveling down the wire like water going down a hose that's been wound in that particular manner. You think you're training the signal, and it's going to squirt out the end and keep turning in that direction. It doesn't do that. You know that your dipole radiates at right angles to the wire. It radiates broadside. The individual pieces of wire of each turn of a helix antenna also radiates broadside. But let's not go there yet. A helix is a slow wave structure. That is to say, the signal traveling down the helix, the signal going down the wire itself, is moving at close to the speed of light, about 0.95 the speed of light. But because the helix has a certain pitch to it, the signal flowing down the helix, if you are measuring it along the axis, is much, much slower than the speed of light. It might be 0.3 as a velocity factor. Your Yagi antenna has a similar characteristic. Let me drop. In the case of a Yagi antenna, your director string is a synthesized dielectric structure. The signal flowing down the boom of your Yagi travels considerably slower than it does in the free space around it. You could build a Yagi-like antenna by having just the right density of foam that's built up around the driven, around the boom of the Yagi. You have the right density of foam in the right areas, and a Yagi that's made, let me pick a number, 10 wavelengths long, built out of foam, or 10 wavelengths long, built out of normal dipole-like rod directors, would have almost the exact same gain, beam width, and whatever. In either case, the foam acting as a slow wave structure, because the foam has a certain dielectric constant, very similar to the polyethylene you've got inside of your RG8 piece of coax. A piece of RG8 coax has a velocity factor of 66%. 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant of the polyethylene tells you the velocity factor, tells you it's 0.66. 1 over the square root is velocity factor of a dielectric material in a piece of coax cable. So I could use chunks of polyethylene as a dielectric material, pack it around the boom of a Yagi-like antenna, and I build what they call a polyrod antenna, but the theory of operation is almost identical to a Yagi. So once you realize that the helix is a slow wave structure, and I'm now giving you three examples of slow wave structure, helix, Yagi made out of dipole elements, or a chunk of foam. Once the velocity factor is properly set, and the length is properly set, and the diameters are properly set, and whatever, you get a focusing action. It is a synthesized slow wave structure that acts like a magnifying glass.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When you use that magnifying glass correctly, and you focus the sun onto your newspaper, and it concentrates those waves down to a small dot, and you can burn up holes in that newspaper and maybe even catch it on fire. Your slow wave structure in front of a helix, your slow wave structure in front of a polyrod antenna, your slow wave structure in front of a Yagi antenna is doing a very similar thing. It's taking a great big chunk of signal in the receive mode from a big diameter of space, focusing it down to the driven element in the case of a Yagi or a polyrod, and then it goes down the transmission line as long as you're properly impedance matched. So a helix has some of those characteristics. There's a lot more to a helix. If you read Krauss's book, and if you just simply, I'm almost positive, if you Google the word Krauss, K-R-A-U-S, the author, and the word helix, I guarantee you we're going to find quite a few articles on the helix antenna giving you a lot better explanation as to what's really going on. But the primary action is slow wave structure. In the case of a Yagi, if I'm building a Yagi that is, let me pick a number, 6 or 8 or 10 wavelengths long, and I really optimize it for maximum gain, minimum beam width, maximum gain, and I'm not worried about beam width, bandwidth right now, you'll find out that not all the directors are the same length. Let me drop. Some of the directors are going to be a little bit longer. I mean, they tend to become slightly shorter as you go toward the forward tip of the Yagi, but there really is, in an optimum design, the length versus position. If I plotted them on a graph, you get sort of a Coke bottle-shaped graph. Some of the directors in the middle are going to be a little bit shorter than the ones further out and closer in toward the driven element when you get an optimum design. In other words, in order to get the maximum gain, the length of each director determines how much local capacitance it has, how much local slow wave structure it has. Therefore, along the boom of a long Yagi, I can plot something called velocity profile. Velocity is the vertical axis. The horizontal axis is positioned along the boom. When I get that velocity profile to have just the right shape, I get maximum gain out of that Yagi structure. If I make the velocity profile of the polyrod antenna the same velocity profile, I'll get maximum gain for that length of polyrod antenna. Therefore, one of the factors that has very poorly been investigated up till now is that for your particular helix, if it is, let me pick a number, 10, 20, 30 turn helix, because you're really going for maximum performance, there is a particular velocity profile you should be matching. Therefore, the circumference of the local turns of the helix should slightly change and not be constant along the length. That's one of the things that rarely has been investigated when it comes to maximum performance out of a helix. Another nasty characteristic you've got with a helix, let me drop, is the way you support the turns makes a huge difference. Lots of people have come up with a beautiful computer-generated or computer-studied, optimized helix design, and they went and built it, and they had very poor performance. Well, how did you support all of those turns? In some cases, they put it on a great big thick piece of PVC tubing, and that's giving them another dielectric loading phenomenon that wasn't part of the computer program. Other guys will put a wooden stick along the top of the helix, so to speak. I've got this helix horizontally displaced along the ground, so to speak, and I've got one wooden stick along the top that supports all the turns. Mechanically, that's good enough. But now the 12 o'clock positions of each one of those turns has a local dielectric loading of that wooden stick compared to the 6 o'clock position. And the net result is you'll get a helix that has very poor axial ratio. The circular polarization out of there is not going to be anywhere near as good as it should be. The ideal helix has a insulating stiff rod down the geometric center, and then you've got individual short rods coming off of it at the 1:30, 6 o'clock, and 10:30 positions, if you know what I mean, every 120 degrees displaced along that boom. You've got these support rods that are holding the individual turns of the helix. There's a whole art and science to properly supporting the turns of the helix. And if you don't obey those rules, the performance you're going to get is a small fraction of what you think it's going to be when it comes to circular polarization quality, gain, and whatever. Let me drop. So as a schematic diagram for circular polarized high gain, reasonably broadband antenna, as a nice physical diagram on a piece of paper, it looks like a simple antenna. By the time you really do a properly designed physical design and electronic design with your method of construction and the gradual tapered impedance match that's required on the very first turn, and maybe you put a terminating resistor on the very last turn, and maybe you're changing the diameters of the turns as you go along the helix to really get maximum performance out of the helix, is not anywhere near as easy as you would think. There are other guys who have tried, who have entered the ham radio amateur antenna gain competitions. A high percentage of them, maybe 85% of them, turned out to be quasi-failure compared to what they expected. So it's a controversial antenna. It's got a lot of capability, but you've got to obey a whole lot of crazy rules that are not obvious at first. I know this is only a little bit of the story of a helix, but maybe this helps somewhat, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Excellent description, Dick. Thank you very much. At least now I know where to go and look. Now, am I correct in assuming that the window aperture is at the end of the helix? Is that correct?
Okay. On any of the volumetric antennas, polyrod, Yagi, or helix, which has a real effective capture area, and what is that area? Area equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. If you really know the gain of the antenna, and you plug it into that formula, gain area equals gain lambda squared divided by 4 pi, you know the area of the antenna in square wavelengths, or whatever units you've used to plug in those numbers. The antenna really has that aperture. If you stand off at a long distance, and if your eyes operate at that frequency, and you look into the antenna, you would see a black round hole in space having that area. And so the signal of the correct polarization characteristics and the correct frequency from a long distance away coming down the boom of that antenna will experience that effective capture area, and the signal will be focused onto what is the equivalent of the driven element, and it goes down the feed line. But now, if I'm standing up close to the antenna, where is that aperture? Yeah, you could say it's in front of the antenna. And if I started making a measurement in the middle of the antenna, do I have a fraction of that aperture? You can't take it apart that way. I mean, it's equivalent to saying, I want to know how this human being works, and I'm going to take him apart. Well, you take him apart, he's not a living animal anymore. Whatever measurement you make is probably an error. And a similar thing happens with a helix antenna. The whole thing has got to be there in free space, fed with the right signal coming from infinity, a planar wave. And so when you get up close to it and you try to find the fine details of what is that effective capture area, life gets complicated. The first time you would ask yourself that question is if I'm stacking a whole lot of helical antennas side by side, as John Krause did with his 96 helix phased array radio telescope. That
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you can see a beautiful picture of that antenna if you Google the right words, or if you go to Krause's book called Radio Astronomy. You'll see a beautiful picture of that phased array, and he does a nice description of its characteristics. John Krause has got not only the book called Antennas, which is in three editions. 1, 2, and 3, and they get better and better as you get to the later editions. And, unfortunately, some of the good information out of the early editions got dropped in the later edition, so it's not quite as good of a later edition as I would expect. On top of that, John Krause has another book you'd like to look into called The Big Ear, that huge radio telescope that he set up at Ohio University. He wrote a book about its design called The Big Ear. It's a paperback book, which is probably out of print, but somewhere it might be available, and that's also in two editions. And he gives a description of his life story as to how he developed the helix antenna. In the Big Ear book, he describes that. In his book called Antennas, he gives you the bottom line, but he doesn't give you the whole history of how he developed that antenna. And it's an exciting story. So through those books, you'll get more information about the helix. Out of curiosity, John, are you intending to use it? And by the way, a guy named Aaron Speck, let me drop this. A very smart scientist named Aaron Speck, who works at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Air Force facility, wrote a number of controversial articles on the so-called backfired helical antenna array. By putting a helical-like antenna with a great big reflector behind it, using it as a feed horn in front of a parabolic dish, he intended to fire the signal in the rearward direction, bounce off the reflector, and then to have the signal come through the helical array a second time in the forward direction and get twice as much gain out of it. That's what he believed. And for the most part, that has not been confirmed. So the so-called helic-like antenna backfire helical array, I think, is a very controversial antenna. I don't think it has anywhere near the performance that people were hoping it would have. Once you understand the theory of operation, you'll realize that that method of analysis and understanding is a bit naive. So I am curious as to how you intend to use a helix. Do you intend to use more than one of them? Do you intend to use it as a feed horn of a parabolic dish? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, I had the chance to purchase one already made. It looked like it might have been an Andrews. It's about 10 years old, and it was in a 900 megahertz. It's a nice-looking device, but I was just wondering what the downfall and the use were. I was thinking of using this for the satellite monitoring. That was basically one of the things I was toying with. But thank you very much for that complete description. Now I can research it. I might have that book, Radio Astronomy, by Krause, in my library. I'm going to have to double-check that.
If you do, you'll see a nice picture of a 96 helix phased array. And my memory of them was it was about 6 helixes high and I guess about 15 helixes wide for one particular panel. And maybe there were two panels. It may have been 96 times 2. But some of his early work on plotting the galactic noise of the universe, where Krause has a whole bunch of diagrams that he published as to a bunch of contours of all of the major galaxies, for instance, in space. What amount of radio noise in Jansky units do you measure by aiming your radio telescope in that direction in the sky? A bunch of those charts of that information was done by Krause, and a lot of the early work was done with that 96 helix array, and the rest of it was done with the great big ear that was that parabolic surface on top of a great big concrete pad that was covered with aluminum foil with two feed horns and a movable flat reflector. That was at the Ohio University Wesleyan Radio Telescope. I visited that facility, by the way. And an awful lot of the electronics were below ground in that radio telescope. And that was in operation for quite a few decades, but unfortunately they lost the possession of the land, and it got traded over to a golf course and to a building development, and that radio telescope got taken apart. And the very first apparent measurement, the very first apparent measurement of an extraterrestrial signal done with that particular radio telescope, the so-called WOW signal, W-O-W. And that's because of the alphanumeric method by which they represented signal strength. And they got a W-O-W out of the machine, so to speak. Or upside down when you look at it, it's M-O-M. But in either case, that particular, what appeared to be radio astronomy extraterrestrial signal, was done at that radio telescope way back in the 1980 time frame, as I remember. And there's a whole bunch of stories about that. Was it real? And because it didn't repeat, there are people who are not sure whether or not it was real. But it followed all the right criteria. The way that radio telescope was set up is there were two separate feed-ons, and it was a so-called meridian transit telescope. In other words, as the Earth rotated 15 degrees per hour, the beam out of that telescope, which was a beaver-shaped, vertically polarized beaver tail-shaped beam, would sweep across the sky. Because the radio telescope had two separate feed horns, there were two separate beams, and as they swept across the sky, you could easily tell the difference between some extraterrestrial interference versus a real celestial object, because the real celestial object would first sweep through beam number one, then sweep through beam number two on the second feed horn, and the amount of timing between those feed horns was an exact number. So if you got the exact same signal strength, the exact same beam width, and it occurred twice through the two separate feed horns, you had extremely strong confirmation that what you're looking at was really an extraterrestrial source. And the WOW signal followed that criteria. So during that hour of that particular day, there really was an extraterrestrial source out there, which by all checking appeared not to be a satellite. It really was an extraterrestrial source giving an extremely strong signal into that L-band radio telescope. But unfortunately, as I said, people went back in that the same direction in space and didn't get a confirmation. So you were about to tell me, oh yes, you were about to buy, that was it. You're about to buy, and as long as you're not spending a whole lot of dollars, it could be a fun thing to have. But know that of all the helical antennas that were built by ham radio operators, this is the one kind of antenna where ham radio operators have a rather poor track record, 80-some-odd percent of them. You talk to, are not successful. You talk to Kent Britton, WA5, Victor Golf Bravo, WA5-VJB, yes. He's the guy who runs the antenna gain measuring procedure that's held at each Central States VHF Society meeting. He's been doing that for the last 15 years. And he starts laughing immediately when anybody shows up with a helical antenna. And as soon as they start making the measurement, it becomes a little bit of a laughing stock. So very few helical antennas. Homebrew have come out.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Very few of them have come out successful for the reasons that I've already indicated. Okay, Wesley's next. I think he said he's got a question. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody. N2XJN. Happy New Year. My question actually started from conversation with Glenn and then with Eric. Following the discussion that we have had about the plasma, but actually property of spark. Well, I'm thinking about spark in gases, spark in radars, spark and speed of spark, because in different medium, ionization of the air, and then during the discussion with Glenn, we get to the point that the sintering of neodymium magnet motors is being done by spark in the temperature near melting. Then, thanks to help of Eric, we've got the information that nanotubes are being called under the environment of spark. Actually, they were discovered this way. Then, what is spark? Photons? How do electrons move through the spark? Very interesting discussion I had with Glenn. Let me jump. Before that, there is an effect of magnet deflection to the spark in plasma. So you have a 2 points, a 1/8 of an inch upwards, and the spark is jumping, creating a plasma, and then you could put the magnet nearby, and you actually can deflect that plasma. So that's the proof that plasma consists from the particles that represent a certain body. Okay, so a certain mass. And how the electron travel in the spark gap? I had the discussion with Glenn how the electron traveled through the copper wire. Okay, so at first there was the we were talking about, okay, it's like we have a bulbs in the row, and the first one pushes the other, and the last one is falling down. So the first one is gonna sooner or later becomes the first one, the last one. But then there was another idea. Actually, Glenn said, well, you know what? Actually, electrons never leaves the atomic structure. They just go to the high orbit, and actually they interfere with, like, I'm going to be cruising around my house, but I'm going to be going to somebody's backyard, and that would be that interferes, and actually I'm energizing another electron that belongs to another atom. Guess what? In ionosphere, you said that electrons are very far, the particles of the air are very far apart, even though they are being ionized. Now, how then the conductivity is that? So there are plenty of questions in this area, actually. But then, if the electron travels whichever way through the copper, how did the electron travel through the ionized spark gap? Back to you.
You're going down a road similar to the one I went down about 3 or 4 years ago. I was on a project where I really wanted to understand at the molecular level what is happening in a spark, an arc, and what is happening even in a piece of copper wire. And to start off with the copper wire, a beautiful puzzle that was in the book called Thinking Physics by Mr. Epstein, a very good book, which is now in its third edition and 29th printing. So it is a popular book. It's a $35 paperback book, Thinking Physics by Epstein. If you see it in your Barnes & Noble or your Border store or whatever, I strongly recommend you buy it. It's one of the best books I've ever bought. Really gives you a lot of understanding of physics. But one of the best puzzles in there gives you a beautiful understanding of what's happening in a copper wire. Let me drop. And the puzzle was, and I'm restating it a little bit, but on a cold winter morning, you turn the key of your automobile, and the starter motor is drawing 200 amperes during the first couple of seconds of locked rotor operation of that starter motor. So 200 amperes is flowing from the battery through roughly 3 feet of very thick copper cable into the starter motor. And if you had the ability with your microscopic instrumentation to see the red electron that's coming out of the negative lead of the battery right now, the car battery, and you watch that red colored electron in my silly example, and you watch it go down that copper wire, how long would it take to reach the starter motor? The answer is 4 hours on average. 4 hours. Now, at the instant you close the switch, the solenoid that powers the starter motor, current starts flowing through that copper wire in 3 nanoseconds. Speed of light is a nanosecond per foot. You've got roughly 3 feet of wire. So from if the solenoid is closing at the starter motor end, the battery knows about it in 3 nanoseconds. But yet, on average, it takes 4 hours for the electron to get there. You see, so what in the world is going on here? Well, that piece of copper wire, whether it be thick, thin, whatever, doesn't matter. It is a pipe. And those electrons are a little bit like shoving marbles into a piece of garden hose. You push a marble into one end, and one pops out of the other end. At the instant you push a marble into one end, the one pops out of the other end, a nanosecond per foot, speed of light almost later. But it's not the same marble. Mother Nature forces you to really balance everything. Every time you take an electron out of the far end of that copper wire, she says you're going to put an electron into the near end. Other than that, you're going to develop a great big potential difference, and she'll stop you from doing it. If Mother Nature would allow you to unbalance the network, if Mother Nature would allow you to drain the freely moving electrons, those electrons really do hop from copper molecule.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They really do hop from copper molecule to copper molecule. The outer ring of those electrons in that copper molecule are free to move, and they do, and they go from molecule to molecule. If Mother Nature would allow you to drain only the freely moving ones in the outer orbit of that copper molecule, if Mother Nature would allow you to drain them out of that piece of copper wire that goes from your car battery to your starter motor, you could draw 400 amperes out of that copper wire for, 200 amperes for 4 solid hours. There's that many free electrons in there. Ain't that amazing? 10 to the 19 electrons per second going by a particular point is 1 ampere, and 200 of those times 4 hours worth of seconds, that's how many free electrons. A huge number. So that gives you one understanding. Now, when it comes to a breakdown in air, here we're talking about ballistics. Every air molecule that's in the room with you right now is moving at roughly 500 meters per second. But they don't get a chance to move 500 meters. The electrons in your room are fairly closely packed to each other. I think they're separated by, I think the answer is 3 nanometers is the average separation. But each individual air molecule is an extremely small device, roughly 1 or 2 angstroms in diameter. And 3 nanometers of separation. There's a 35-to-1 ratio between their diameter and their separation. Each individual air molecule moves roughly 63 nanometers before it strikes another air molecule. They're all moving at 500 meters per second on average. The mean free path is around 63 nanometers. When you and I create a E-field...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When we create a high voltage between two probes and we adjust the spacing and the voltage so that we end up with 30,000 volts per centimeter, 3 million volts per meter of E-field, that magic number for air at room temperature is such that if a cosmic ray comes along, strikes one of those air molecules, and that's one of the ways that the process gets initiated, a cosmic ray comes along, strikes one of those air molecules, and frees one single electron away from one of those air molecules. When the voltage is as high as 30 volts per centimeter, 30,000 volts per centimeter, that electron gets a chance to be accelerated to a high enough velocity that 63 nanometers later, when he strikes the next air molecule, he has enough kinetic energy to start impact ionization. He strikes that air molecule, the next one, 63 nanometers away, with enough velocity that he breaks away another electron and he begins the avalanche process. So it is a matter of enough voltage at room temperature, room air pressure, to get enough velocity to do the breakdown. When you go to a lower air pressure, the separation between the molecules is greater. If I go to half atmospheric pressure, the mean free path, instead of being 63 nanometers, is probably something like 126 nanometers. Now the air molecule gets a lot more chance to build up velocity in that E field. Therefore, he strikes the next air molecule a hell of a lot faster. therefore he does the avalanching process a lot easier.